Well, first off, I would like to spend a little time together learning from you what was your experience of doing the Four Elements meditation. What came up for you? Did you find it easy? Did you find it difficult? How did you find that it differed from insight practice? I'd really like to just do a little sharing so we can get some sense of what that was like, how it went for you.
John, I'm not being a little too analytical, I think.
Oh, okay.
How's the pulse like fire?
Yeah, it's easy to overthink. Yeah, right. Okay, good. Yeah. Please.
I have a question. Under which of the four elements would hurting be
pain?
Hurting. Pain. I sort of started getting an earache.
Yeah, it's a fire element.
Aching.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's energy, it's the expression of energy. Yeah, please.
I'm not sure why this happened, but when we had our hands so we could pulse, mine just felt like they were just glued together. Like I couldn't move my hand, I couldn't lift them, I couldn't do anything. Mm-hmm. They were just locked in.
Could you feel your pulse?
No, actually.
You were worried about whether you could undo your hands.
No, I just felt like they were just one unit together.
Yeah.
They were so incredibly heavy. I really could not do anything.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, good. So, yeah, please.
I was wondering what element the cloth is.
Well, we did the easy version, the short version. Later on in the Majjhima Nikaya, the Buddha teaches this practice in a somewhat more elaborate way, and he includes two more elements. One is space, and the other is consciousness. And basically by that, what he means is training the mind to depersonalize the experience of consciousness so that if you note the mind just doing, like it, don't like it, don't care, it's the Vedana, that you just note that as something else is going on in the universe. Sound basically is a combination of space and fire. You know, it's the transmission of energy through space. Yeah. Okay. Please.
Did you say that pain was fire or air?
Fire.
Fire.
We talked about, earth, water, fire, and air.
So I fell asleep during that part.
That's where I sleep.
Okay. And actually, in terms of working with pain, it can be useful to categorize in that way because it also depersonalizes a little bit. So, it's an expression of energy in the body that the mind is judged to be unpleasant. So, yes, any other, yes, Lauren?
I was surprised that I was really tired.
Yeah.
It actually helped me to feel awake, isn't really like the word, but I was so grounded that it was no longer an issue.
Right.
It was nice.
That's the magic word, grounded. In the Buddha's teachings on the four foundations of mindfulness, the first foundation being breathing in the body. This is it. This is a way to really get down with what it means to be in a body, what it means to be there. Did anyone find it, so some people found, difficult, made them sleepy. Anyone enjoy it? Enjoy it. Like it.
Yeah.
I do too. For me, it's kind of like going for a walk in your own little internal park. It tends to have the effect of quieting down the discursive mind a little bit because you're just being in your body, and the thoughts can be kind of extraneous. Yeah, please.
I was wondering if I concentrated on the polish, and then it was timed exactly with the ticking of the clock. So that was very calming.
Interesting. Right. Yeah, please.
It reminded me of that, you know, Mother Earth gives us every single thing we need to be really happy and healthy, and how we abuse her so terribly. But then it also reminded me, that thought reminded me of gardening, and how when I'm doing my vegetable garden, which I haven't done for a couple of years, live in a condo now, anyway, when you're rooting around in the dirt or getting the dirt under your fingernails, it reminds you that every single thing we have comes from dirt.
Yeah, not separate. Right? Good, thank you. Anything else?
When you say consciousness, you mean just like the same way you would use the fifth skandha?
Yeah. The way the Buddha described it is, you know, if you just note activity in the mind, you know, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, it's just another, basically it's just another form of energy kind of movement through the body. So ultimately, all aspects of that practice are a way to help the mind learn to not take who we are quite so personally, right? That we are basically just like everything else. The reason the Buddha taught the practice is because of his discovery that it is in fact the activities of the discursive mind that create the sense of self, that therefore creates the sense of separation, of being separate from, distinct from, okay, the other people around us, separate from and distinct from all sentient beings, separate from and distinct from nature, from the very forces and elements that constitute who we are. And so one of the purposes of doing the four elements meditation is to quiet, to turn the attention away from the activities of the discursive mind, the I-making and the me-making and the list-making and the, you know, who am I, and so on and so forth, and just turn the attention to the literal experience of being of the earth and nothing else. Okay. So it's kind of like a figure and ground experience. You know, for the most part, in most of our lives, the figure, what's in front of us, is our own projections into the mirror that then tells us who we think we are, right? And everything else is in the background. Everybody else and everything else is playing a supporting role to the star of the show, who is, of course, I. And what this does is essentially to do a shift, where instead of it being me with everything else in the background, instead, it's the background. It's everything that becomes the star of the show. So this was one of several practices that he taught that have the effect of beginning to soften that shell, that sense of self, that identity with the specifics of who we are. And essentially to say, you know, in a very fundamental way, we are that which is around us. When it's practiced really deeply and for a sustained period of time, it can really have the effect of beginning to soften and slow down and relax and disempower the I-making and me-making functions of the mind, and allow you to just settle into this sense of groundedness. You know, just being a being, just another sentient being in the universe at this moment in time. When I go down to do my meditation practice in the mornings, after I settle in and check the posture and all that, Usually the four elements practice is the first thing I do, because it has just that effect, you know. The mind's already churning away of, you know, what the day's activities may consist of and all that kind of thing. But then once you sit down, then you can just sort of remind yourself, well, that's then, that's in the future, this is now, this is here. Let's see what it feels like just to be here, literally, just to be this thing, this fathom-long body on the earth, okay? And to really allow the consciousness to sink into that state. So you may have some aches and pains, or you may have digestive issues, or you may not have slept well, or whatever, but essentially, when you relax the mind that way, it just sort of starts sifting everything out. You know, the image the Buddha uses for what goes on when you do with the four elements is kind of gory, actually. It's imagine you were watching a butcher chop up an ox. It starts out looking like one cohesive entity, and then all of a sudden it's baby back ribs, and it's, you know, steaks, and it's this, that, and the other thing. It's a kind of, so what he was trying to get at is it's a kind of a dissembly, you know. You're really relaxing the mind, so rather than cohesing around the sense of self, you're relaxing it into the universe of which we're a part. And as you really do this practice, you know, for a relatively long period of time, a whole sit maybe, or some of the monasteries in Thailand, if you're in Southeast Asia, if you're doing a long retreat, you might do this practice for a couple of weeks, like that. And the effect of it, when the mind gets that calm and that relaxed, is it begins to bring you up to the edge of a taste of not-self. You know, the mind gets so relaxed that it becomes less and less inclined to want to create the self. And you find yourself just kind of sort of dissolving into the environment a little bit, which is one of the reasons it's not all that popular. It's one thing to do that kind of shamatha practice at a level that allows the mind to get a little calmer and stop chatting quite so much and settle into the body. But the deeper the mind gets into the experience of the body and nothing else, the less time and energy it's putting into creating the self, the more closely you draw to the experience of the infinite. And if you're ready to go there, it can be very, very freeing and very enlightening. It can also, all of a sudden, you know, the ego wakes up and says, this really isn't fun anymore. Oh, no, you know, I'm dissolving, you know, like... Yeah. Dorothy threw water on the witch. But that very aspect of this practice goes right to the core of the Buddhist teachings of anatta, or not self. The Tibetan meditation master Kali Rinpoche he wrote this very famous poem that I know a lot of you have heard me say a lot of times, but I really find it captures this moment quite well. He said, you live in illusion and the appearance of things. You know, by which he means we live in the illusion that we are separate from the other, that we are separate from nature. So, you live in illusion and the appearance of things. There is a reality. You are that reality, but you do not know it. When you realize that this is so, you see that you are nothing, not self. And that being nothing, you are everything. You are the universe. That is all. You live in illusion and the appearance of things. There is a reality. You are that reality, but you do not know it. When you realize that this is so, you see that you are nothing, and that being nothing, you are everything. That is all. So it's that opening the way into the experience of unity, of literally being that which is, rather than being somebody observing that which is. You sort of step through a portal, you know, through the looking glass. If there's no more looking glass, then there's no more self to look at yourself. You've just become that which is around you in a very, very complete sense. So, this dissolution of boundaries, whether it's temporary or lasts a long time, it can feel quite freeing, quite liberating, it can be quite disturbing. Okay. One of the reasons that, again, that the Four Elements practice is, you know, people sometimes have ambivalent feelings about it. It's because when you relax self to the point where you are in that complete and whole relationship with everything around, okay, it really heightens your sentience, you know. And many environmentalists say, you know, it's what's crucially important in order for enough of us to get sufficiently motivated to devote ourselves to saving all sentient beings, you know, and healing creation, is the necessity of developing a sentient personal relationship with the environment. It can't just stop at reading an article in a scientific journal about climate change or something like that. It's something that really has to be felt at a personal level. And the problem with that, the difficulty with sentience at that level, is that it can be painful. You know, you're opening yourself up to the pain of the world. And a passage I know a lot of you have heard me read before, probably more than once, the observation of the Sufi master Pir Vilayat Khan: overcome any bitterness that may have come to you because you were not up to the magnitude of pain that was entrusted to you. Like the mother of the world who carries the pain of the world in her heart, each one of us is part of her heart, and therefore endowed with a certain measure of cosmic pain. You are sharing in the totality of that pain, and you are called upon to meet it in joy instead of self-pity. You are sharing in the totality of the pain of the mother of the world, and you are called upon to meet it in joy instead of self-pity. So to be a sentient being is to open yourself to the joys and the sufferings of other sentient beings in addition to yourself. That's why to do work like environmental advocacy, for instance, or social work, or anything else for that matter, entails a certain willingness to be with, okay, to be with that suffering, to be with that pain. Okay. And we know that caregivers and psychotherapists and others, you know, in order to do their job well, they need to be sentient, while at the same time they also need to have some boundaries so that they can take in that measure. They're serving of the pain without letting it overwhelm them. You know, it's something that we all have to do to take care of ourselves And yet when I began to really invest myself pretty deeply in environmental advocacy work after retirement, it's one of the things I realized. You know, it's rewarding work. I like, you know, working with others to do some of the things we're doing, and it's painful. Because I see people suffering, people that we're trying to help, you know, in the neighborhoods of Globeville area and Swansea up north. Kids have a 40% higher rate of emergency room admission with asthma attacks than any other neighborhood in the city, than any other zip code in the state. 70% higher rate of congestive heart disease. Okay. Both of those conditions are directly attributable to highway exhaust and to the emissions from the Suncor refinery in southern Adams County. Okay. So I love to go out hiking in the mountains and the, you know, in the nearby parks and observing wildlife. It's one of the things that really restores me. But over the last year, I've also been spending more and more time in those neighborhoods, you know, visiting with and working with the people who live there to try to improve the situation. And it's hard. It's hard because we've been taught for most of our lives to avoid the unpleasant, you know, to not be willing to come up to and be with that which is difficult to bear, which is, you know, the classic definition of dukkha. We've been taught to turn away, you know. And in fact, the practice of karuna or compassion in the Buddha's teachings is exactly the opposite. Said, you know, if you cannot be with the suffering of others, you cannot be with your own suffering. And what you do is cut yourself off from yourself, and you deaden yourself, and you isolate yourself because you don't feel like you're up to the magnitude of pain. So part of understanding and practicing Buddha Dharma is to understand that this pain, this difficulty, when it arises, it has its place. It's part of being a sentient person in the world. And to cut oneself off from or try to avoid that experience is to cut oneself off from life. Because at the same time you cut yourself off, you know, to try to avoid experiencing the difficult or the suffering, you also cut yourself off from joy and true happiness. You know, the Dalai Lama said once, you know, we seek pleasure when we cannot find happiness. And oftentimes the doorway, or the thing that liberates joy, is the acceptance of suffering. Sounds, you know, contradictory, but in fact, the two are really related. I was at a conference of legal scholars and law professors and students and others a few years ago, where we were focusing on these very issues. We were looking at environmental law and policy and some of the major issues that are coming up, and the need for there to be, you know, this, we can't just do it in court, you know, there really has to be an underlying social movement that turns things around. And this one law professor from Tulane down in Louisiana was giving this talk, and he said that he's, you know, been active in environmental advocacy circles for a long time. And friends would come visit him from other parts of the country and say, well, let's go out for a canoe trip or something, outdoors people. And so what he would do would be to organize these canoe trips where they would canoe up some of the inlets in and around the port of New Orleans, you know, which for the most part are pretty nasty. You go along and there'd be some, you know, there'd be some wildlife, and there'd be some bayou and some open space, and then all of a sudden there'd be some rusted old, you know, oil tank or some half-sunken boat or something. And so just some, you know, really damaged, scarred landscape. And so he'd take his friends out on these trips, and they come back and they go, yeah, you know, why did we do that? You know, I know that there's really, you know, beautiful backwater further up the river and here and there where we could have gone and really checked out the wildlife. And he said, the reason I do that is because I don't think we're really going to make any significant progress going forward. And these two words are really interesting. They go together, I think, kind of in an interesting way for us these days. Reclamation and recreation. You know, that if we are to reclaim our environments, if we are to reclaim our air, if we are to reclaim our water, okay, then, as he put it, we have to learn to love scarred landscapes. So instead of just heading for the mountains every time we have, I mean, I think it's really important to do that, and I do it when I can too, but to not avoid looking at that which is difficult to bear. You know, because with sentient eyes, you know, because once we are able to really acknowledge that, yes, this is damage, this is suffering, these are people suffering because of decisions that have been made about how we're going to treat our environment. Okay. That if we, until we can allow our sentience to come to rest on those perceptions and let them motivate us to do the work necessary to heal the landscapes around us, instead of just avoiding what we see there, okay, then meaningful change isn't going to happen. You know? It's going to happen because enough of us feel that it's imperative that it happen, and that it happen now, and that we're willing to do what we can to make that happen. And that means not turning away from that which is difficult to bear. So there's that. So let's speak about these things. Anyone have any questions or comments you'd like to share? Yes, please.
And the place I like to go to see the beauty of the waste is up around Central City. The mountains are there and the Indian peaks and everything, and then there's all these tailings piles and the glory hole, and it's just a mess. And it stayed that way for... It will stay that way.
When we moved here to Denver about 30 years ago, and among the people that we befriended not too long after getting here was a fellow who is a field ecologist working under contract to Morrison Knudsen Engineering Firm, which had been contracted by the U.S. Army and Shell Oil to do reclamation work at the Rocky Mountain Arsenal. And the arsenal is one of the most poisoned places on Earth. You know, they manufactured biological weaponry out there throughout World War II, and then they manufactured some extraordinarily toxic weed killers and things there for many years afterwards, and they just threw all their waste into a big hole in the ground. And it's, you know, it's tragically, you know, compromised land. It was unfit to do anything other than basically make it into a wildlife refuge, because the cost of trying to get it clean enough to, you know, build homes on it was going to be infinite. There was no way that was going to be possible. You have to spend the nation's entire Superfund budget just to clean that one place up. So gradually, they made it at least clean enough that you have wildlife making a pretty good living out there that are not radioactive and, you know, have the right number of legs and heads and tails and whatnot. So some healing has actually gone on out there, you know. When I was invited to tour a fracking site out on in eastern Arapahoe County a year or so ago, and I was the guest of the person who's responsible for bringing the 3 million gallons of water needed to frack a well site to the site, and he said, yeah, we're making progress, and we're trying to get better at recycling the water we use and whatnot, but in the meantime, it's just a big holding pit for the water they used in the last frack, and there was some dead wildlife floating around in it. They put fences around it and whatnot, but when the wildlife get thirsty, or when, like, you know, waterfowl are flying by and they see a nice pond, they land and they don't take off. So this wounding, you know, is going on all the time. And for the most part, it's going on without really being acknowledged very much, or it's kind of accepted as just sort of it's part of the process. And so without being condemnatory and dualistic, there is a case to be made for applying one's sentience to calling out that suffering. You know, not just, you know, certainly for the people that live alongside really polluted areas, but just looking at the totality of the harm that's being done and witnessing for it and speaking up about it and not turning our backs on it because it hurts. And it does. It really does. But being able to accept a certain amount of that pain is, that's actually part of doing the work. That's been my experience as well. It can be a motivating factor as well as a disturbing one. Please, yes, please.
So a couple of years back, I got a concussion, and as part of the experience of it, in a sense, it became very acute.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody knows how it is to get a head injury. The lights are very bright, the sounds, and never forget hearing sound of a leaf blower.
Yeah.
Outside, it was piercing. So I ended up asking the neighbor not to do that. But then I did some research, and it turns out that leaf blowers are terrible.
Yeah.
In terms of the decibels, but also the exhaust. And there are places in California, whole counties, that have actually outlawed them. It's been done. But it leads to sort of thinking about like how the body takes in the noise of the engines of lawnmowers and leaf blowers. And I've become an active, but it's a tough thing. I think one of the things that has been causing me pain is talking to neighbors who say, well, can't there be a compromise about the leaf blower?
Uh-huh.
And I want to say no. But, you know, it's really right there, I think, that I get.
If there's demand, there are, I'm sure there are technological solutions. You know, you can make quieter leaf blowers if places like California start outlawing them. Cleaner snowmobiles than the ones that we have now. If there's the demand for them, it can certainly happen, but it really does involve people speaking up. I have my body over the years, you know, having grown up in southern Arizona as a kid, in later years, it's gotten to growing all kinds and all sorts of dermic misbehaviors. You know, because actinokeratoses and squamous cell and, you know, basal cell carcinomas, and one nice melanoma on the back of my neck a couple of years ago. And I have so many of those actinokeratoses, and it's a precancerous lesion, on my forearms that the dermatologist recommended that I have this, it's called the blue light treatment done. And what that consists of is first scrubbing down the forearms or whatever area is going to be treated with acetone, you know, down to a pretty deep level, and then putting on an acid cream that eats away the top layer of the dermis, okay? day that stays on for about 2 hours, and then putting your forearms under this in this blue light box where it zaps all the actinic keratoses for about 15 minutes. Unpleasant, to say the least.
Especially to your liver and the acetone.
The worst part was the acetone. It was horrible. You know, I started coughing and whatnot, and the registered nurse that was doing the application, she said, "Well, you know, I have a little handheld fan that they give you if you want, so you don't choke on the stuff." So I was using that, but it was a closed space with no real meaningful ventilation, and I said, "Do you do this all day long?" And she said, "Well, yeah, that's my job here." And I said, "Didn't you know that acetone's a carcinogen?" And she didn't. She didn't have any kind of mask or breathing apparatus, neither of us did. And I said, "Well, you know, I should imagine the Occupational Safety and Health Administration has some views on this. You may want to check the literature out." She said, "Well, I will. I guess I really should really talk to somebody." And I couldn't believe that, you know, and this is a healthcare professional, the kind of chemical assault that was going on for her day in, day out on the job. And some of it, so much of it just kind of sort of goes by unquestioned, you know.
Above all else, do no harm.
And one of the elementary schools down in the Globeville neighborhood, where we've been doing some work, one of the parents there works for a firm that does air quality monitoring, air quality sampling and whatnot. So he brought some equipment from work in there, and they tested the air quality at Garden Place Academy down there in Globeville. And among the things they found in the mix in the air was about 5 parts per billion of benzene, which is a known carcinogen. It's known to cause childhood leukemia. So he brought this to the attention of the Denver Public School System and the Denver Department of Environmental Health. And so they had done some air quality monitoring in the area, and they said, "Well, it's a shame that this stuff is in the school, but," they said, "it's also in the air all around you. The ambient air quality in that neighborhood contains 5 parts per billion of benzene." Okay. So everybody in the neighborhood is breathing that all the time. But one of the projects I'm involved in right now is doing what we call safe, healthy schools, Safe Healthy School Initiative. Okay. And the place where we're coming from is that a child can die of chemical violence just as surely as if they got shot in the head. You know, just as surely as if they died by gun violence. It just takes longer. And it doesn't even always manifest when they're in school, but that doesn't mean it ought to be acceptable. You know, so that at the very least, maybe we can start making our schools havens of health and well-being, even if the surroundings aren't necessarily, you know. But it takes people speaking up, you know. It's like the schools district saying, "Well, you know, that's the area where you live, right? So there's benzene in the school, there's benzene outside." What makes it worse inside, of course, is it's a confined environment, and the air doesn't circulate all that well. But for the parents who live there, that response is not really an acceptable one. Well, yeah, the air is filthy and dangerous in your kid's school, but, you know, it is in the rest of the neighborhood, too. Somehow that just doesn't feel good enough.
In focusing, you were talking about working with the four elements externally, and I've kind of been playing with it, and I kind of think grit would maybe be form and air. I'm not sure if that means you observe, if there's no people there, you know. know, how you observe that, but then you said space was a different one. And then I was trying to figure out, as you see pattern and movement, so in other words, could you just talk a little bit about how you do this outward a little bit?
Yes, absolutely. On retreat, for instance, if you're, and I would find myself gravitating toward the air element a fair amount, you know, while we were sitting. And then when we go out walking, this was at in Barre, Massachusetts, out of hardwood forests, and there was a breeze blowing. And so going outside and watching the swaying of the trees, you know, there is this sense of, yeah, there's the air element, you know, moving through the trees, and the trees, the leaves of the trees are breathing just like I am. And so just watching the trees somehow, there is this kind of affinity that, you know, was established. And then we went into the next sitting, and this little sitting hall with the windows open. It was a nice day. And the breeze was blowing through the hall, just like it was outside. And at some point, when I was sitting there just watching the breath and then feeling the breeze, it's like it just carried me away. It's just gone. And that's happened to me, actually, when I find the time, when I go out for day hikes, around here, especially up in the hills. Usually take an inflatable cushion and do some sitting. Go out there and sit in the woods sometimes. And that's a wonderful place to do this for elements meditation, because you really can just melt into the landscape, and all of a sudden it's an hour or so later, you know. But the mind has become completely quiet, and the body has just become attuned, you know, really becomes no different from that which is around you. If you're just walking in a park sometime or going out for a hike, if there's any surface water, you can notice.
But if there isn't water?
If there isn't water, anything green's got water in it. So like, I was sitting out there doing the four elements practice before we came into set, and looking at the grass, for instance, you know, and just knowing that what's making it green is the fact that it's got moisture in it. You know, it's doing photosynthesis.
Fluids in the body?
Huh?
I said fluids in other people's body, maybe. I'm just trying to...
The Buddha talked about sort of the fluidity, right, you know. It's certainly something to focus on. Air element, if you're outside the sun, you know, if it's hot or if it's cold, you know, the temperature differential is something to look at. The sensation of your feet on the ground, you know, as the earth element. So there are ways to focus on outside. And the interesting thing for me has been, from time to time, if I've been down in the Global neighborhood, you know, it's easy to do this if you're, you know, up in Golden Gate Canyon State Park or somewhere. How about doing it down there? How about taking in the air element when you know there's a little benzene in it? You know, it's like, okay, this is, you know, this is where the work is. This is what we need to be doing. We need to be removing the barriers from us being able to take life, you know, have our life sustained by the environment around us instead of being threatened by it. A lot to do. And the greater challenge even is how do you do it with a joyful heart? How do you do it in a way that avoids getting burned out and being overcome by the magnitude of pain that was entrusted to us? And that's where the Dharma comes in. You know, I realized early on, getting involved in some of the work I'm doing with Sierra Club, that this work at this level of intensity would not be possible. if it weren't for the Dharma. It also wouldn't be possible if it weren't for the Sangha. You know, there can be a real feeling of loneliness doing this kind of work, whether it's a Sangha of people that I work with in the field, or this Sangha. You know, I often feel myself really quite nourished and supported and held and cared for, as I know, you know, some of the others of us do as well. And so for me, this is a precious place. It's a place of, for me, of renewal, you know, of recreation. You know, it's a place where I feel that all things become possible, you know, because we are that which is around us. The other thing that sustains it is not just our sangha, but what we do when we're here, which is to say, you know, when we are practicing sincerely at any given point in time, some number of us, whether in this room or elsewhere, other people that are doing this practice, find themselves in what we call the deva realms, feeling really deep compassion, feeling really deep selfless joy, you know, the Brahma Viharas, deep sense of equanimity, open-heartedness. And this is something that I'm coming to experience as my lived reality from time to time, which is that when some number of us find ourselves in that place, there's tremendous power there. And there is beneficence. There's support that we can actually draw on. You know, in Buddhist cosmology, there are these 31 planes of existence, and the one just above the human realm is what's called the Deva realm. You know, and there's talk of the Devas. There's sort of likened sometimes like to angels or beneficent non-corporeal beings or spirits that can come to one's assistance. There's different ways to understand that. I personally think it's worth keeping an open mind about. One way to understand it is that it is a realm of support that's available to us when we tune into it. You know, even if it's just the collective expression of the consciousness of some of us at any given point in time being in the Deva realms, you know, embodying the Brahma Viharas. And that way, when we do that Brahma Vihara practice, we're actually doing it not only for ourselves, but for each other as well. You know, it's a practice that has the potential for sustaining us and holding us up and helping each other. So let's take our sitting posture again for just a moment if we can.
Protect you. Sava Buddha Nubhava.
Happy Earth Day.